say good evening to Paul Mears.
Well, good evening and welcome to another edition of Penalty Spot. Of course, in association with the Barbados Football Association. Well, coming up on today's program, we get the very latest developments in the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association ongoing saga. In the club corner, we feature Paradise FC. And the player profile, Anthony Daisy Clark, is back in the spotlight. Some big decisions are being made across the European Football League after the announcement from France and the Netherlands that the seasons have been cancelled. We have a comprehensive roundup of the very latest international stories. This is the Penalty Spot in association with the Barbados Football Association. And I take it up to the And I take this opportunity to welcome you back to our second program in the new series of Penalty Spot. It is time to talk football. But first up, we're going to have a look around the very latest international stories. As I say, good evening to Curtis Hines.
Very good evening to you, Paul. Good evening to Larry. And good evening to all of the fans. And welcome to another edition of Penalty Spot. Of course, compliments the Barbados Football Association. As per usual, you can reach us 43-41-790. You can also reach us at 18sports246@gmail.com. But of course, COVID-19 continues to monopolize all of the headlines across the world. And as Paul would have mentioned in our intro, a number of the European clubs now have made a number of key decisions. We are now at the start of May. There's the general consensus that if you do not start the season before the end of June, you will have to scrap it. We've seen the French league coming to a close with PSG being declared as the champions outright. So PSG are the champions, an interesting subplot there. Neymar has been linked heavily with a move away from the club after, I believe, what would have been two or three seasons. And that could be his last trophy at the club, of course. Went to PSG from Barcelona, where he won just about everything with the club. And this was in an effort, many say, to win the individual honor for best player in Europe and lead aside as opposed to playing second fiddle to Messi, as everyone will have to do at Barcelona. But he's now being tipped with the return to Barcelona and having to take at least a 50% pay cut. But of course, the French league is now finished. The Dutch league, well, they called that to a close a few days ago, but now there is a case brewing and a number of the clubs, primarily among the bottom clubs, are protesting against the league being cancelled because they are saying now that they lost the opportunity to avoid relegation. Of course, with the TV money involved, relegation is sometimes a matter of plus or minus up to $50 million. So you can see it's a really key issue for clubs across Europe. In terms of the English Premier League, which normally gets a lot of attention of Barbadian football fans, the number of club doctors have raised a range of concerns. League bosses over plans to resume the season. One issue is that the senior medics have sought assurances over their work situations, which includes their own liability and insurance cover if a player contacts the virus. And the Premier League has also been asked to provide some clarity over medical protocols, testing, and player welfare. And of course, the English Premier League is hopeful of a potential June 8th resumption of the action. A number of the clubs have begun training. Arsenal began last week. Chelsea invited their players who would have gone home. The likes of Willian went back to Brazil and invited them to come back to the club to begin training as they hope to begin action in the first week of June. Lots more international action, Paul, but of course, Corona still taking the precedence, and including in Germany, where they returned to training, I believe that was last week, and a number of players, 10 players in to be exact, from the two top leagues in Germany, have tested positive for Corona. And the league, the Bundesliga, was tipped to start on May 9th, but may now restart. That's this weekend, but may now restart as late as May 16th or the 23rd. And it is still a very, very fluid situation. I expect to have Ronaldo PB Jilts on the line. any moment to...
He's there, Curtis.
So good evening to you, PB. Welcome to the program. And I haven't seen you for a while. No local action going on, as you would have heard. Germany, training has resumed. Some issues there. England, training has resumed. They're hoping to start the first week in June. Before we go any further, though, you've worn all the hats. Player, coach, manager, head of the youth committee. Your thoughts on what's going on in Europe as it pertains to this resumption of training and one league looking to start as soon as this upcoming weekend.
Well, good evening again to the A team. Always a pleasure to be in the company of the A team. To be honest, I think that they should cancel leagues and put health at the forefront of everything that's going on. Like, let's take England, for example, where you have Liverpool with a 20-plus lead, and then they just need 6 points from, I imagine, 8 games or so. In order for that league to finish, the English league to finish, they would need 26,000 kits. So then the powers that be need to make a decision. Is finishing the league more important than the welfare of the remainder of the country? Because I imagine those are 26,000 kits that can be used to cater to the other citizens and people in England. I think that France made a just call. It was going to be wrapped up with PSG anyway, but this time the health and the welfare of all involved, not just the players, but I heard you guys mention just now the report from the doctors. They have their concerns, and if the doctors have concerns, then I imagine the football persons need to adhere. Me, for one, whenever my medical personnel gives me advice on players with regards to illness or injury and recovery and so on, I listen, because we need healthy athletes, we need standard athletes to give you value for what you're paying for. So my take on it is basically cancel the leagues until we get a healthier environment in all of the countries. Maybe looking at, I think it was the CONCACAF president, Victor Montigliani, who said we may have to start looking at putting the league in January and running it by the calendar year. And I think it made sense from the perspective of, one, first of all, having everybody healthy, but two, when you look at 2022 World Cup, it's actually going to be held in November and December. So if you start the league in January, you could probably end the league by July, which gives the international teams an opportunity to rest and also prepare. So we may be looking at having a new European league starting in January, a new type of season.
Of course, the European situation in particular complicated by the fact that Euro this year has been postponed to 2021. You also have the Olympic Games, so real estate in terms of space to run major competitions with your top players involved is going to be a bit more contentious, as you spoke about the testing required before football can resume. Frank Lampard, the current Chelsea manager, said yesterday that he would have a moral problem, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, with players having access to up to 24,000 kits, as you mentioned. Kits are very, very hard to come by. Ahead of what he described as the first responders, the people who are also ill as well, who would normally be in line to get a kit. And he says it's going to be an issue where you instead take these kits and provide them to footballers, because they would also assume, well, you will need a test before you start. There will also be some in-season testing, so you can vouch that you're still safe as well. Some more European news today. Liverpool goalkeeper Lloris Karius has ended his two-year loan deal at Besiktas, the Turkish side. The 26-year-old was in the second year of his spell and made 30 appearances before the season was stopped due to COVID-19. Apparently, he's not being paid, and he says he tried to resolve the situation amicably, but he's going back to Liverpool, of course. Lloris famously had an error-strewn display in the Champions League final. Two big errors, and was remembered for that, was subsequently booted down to the number two position, sent out on loan. And of course, Liverpool now, I believe it's Alisson, looking very, very strong between the uprights. In terms of the transfer market, which is expected to be a bit strange this season because the number of clubs will not have that much money to spend, Liverpool are linked with Timo Werner. Willian from Chelsea is linked with just about everyone away from Chelsea, but apparently he's calling for a lot of money in terms of his personal terms. He's been linked with the Barcelona. He's been linked with Real Madrid. He's been linked with Arsenal and Tottenham. Willian says he would prefer to stay in England. I'm sure that would not be the wish of Chelsea. They would not want that. The English chairman of the FA, Greg Clark, has said it's hard to see fans returning to play matches anytime soon. And Pee Wee, I want to bring you in on this one once again. Football in an empty venue, not ideal for the players, not ideal for the fans, but safety being at its paramount, it's really a no-win situation.
Yeah, I mean, football without fans is like pizza without toppings, right?
There you go.
You need them to add that extra bit to the atmosphere. I don't know how I've seen it in Italy where there have been matches played behind closed doors because of suffering bans for discrimination and so forth. But I think to restart the game behind closed doors, especially for the amount of games remaining, obviously, as you mentioned earlier, Curtis, there's the financial component to consider. May not be considerably for the Premier League because most of their money comes from TV deals. But I think for like some of the lower leagues who depend on the people coming through the gates to basically keep them afloat in the financial ring. Obviously, that situation also rolls over to us here in Barbados. Like, if we do resume this year, do we play behind closed doors as well? It would be somewhat of a strange feeling, even for you guys who do the coverage. I mean, yeah. It would be somewhat strange. We often depend and look at the crowd to add an accessory to watching the game. But how do we basically acquaint ourselves to this new norm? How do we position ourselves to deal with a sport such as football where the crowd noise, like sometimes when my younger cousin's playing FIFA, for them, they don't turn the sound off. As long as you can't play a game with the sound off because the atmosphere, the crowd is all part of the game.
Exactly. So thank you very much, Ronaldo, PB Jokes. As we look across Europe, of course, well-known coach, chairman of the BFA's youth committee, and a very decorated Premier League player currently at the helm of the Weymouth Wales club. Before we switch forces and focus, once again, I can tell you some more European news. La Liga organizers, that's Spain, are aiming for a June restart of the season with the clubs all returning to practice this week. Graeme Souness, the Sky Sports commentator, is saying it's going to be very difficult to get all of the British clubs to agree to end the season early or play at neutral grounds because the teams who are set for relegation are going to protest and perhaps sue, as you would have heard from Kenneth Onyekwe last week. And Paul, on another big story, which broke, I believe it was on Saturday, the U.S. women's football team had sued the country's FA for basically discrimination, pay discrimination. They said they needed the same pay structure as the men's team and pointed to the fact that they've been far more successful on the international stage, which is true. I believe the USA has won the Women's World Cup on two or three occasions. The men's team not doing that well. Well, the case was thrown out, but the team now has announced that it will appeal the decision to have the pay being normalized. And in a strange situation, Paul, believe it or not, a former Schalke star in Germany is being found alive in Germany. This is 4 years after he was reported dead following a car crash in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And his ex-wife is now being investigated for insurance fraud.
Reported dead in
2016. But he's apparently 33 years old, and working as a chemical technician, as an energy supplier in Germany. So him and the wife have some serious explaining to do.
Wow. Very much so. What a story. I want to say thanks also, Curtis, to Ronaldo Pee Wee Jones for joining us.
Hey.
Sure, we'll hear a lot more from him over the next few weeks. And right on the button, Curtis, is that story out of the USA, the decision by the U.S. court to reject a claim by the women's players for equal pay. And we have a very special feature on that this evening. We have the president of the Women's Sports Foundation in the U.S., Alana Nichols, and she shares some thoughts on that development.
What has the reaction been like in the USA over the weekend to that judge's decision?
It's devastating. It's a hard time in general, and that was kind of getting hit while you're already down. But as he said, it, you know, these are some of the most amazing, strong women. And, you know, Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan, they're not settling for less. They're not happy with the crumbs and they're going to keep fighting. And, you know, that's the reaction that we've seen here. And really, it's inspiring to know, you know, everybody is going through adversity in their own lives, and to watch the women deal with this in a real way and not back down is really inspiring for this time in general. And, you know, I think they're inspired for themselves, but it's really about the next generation of girls and paving the way for them. And that's a motivation I think they have that is unwavering. And that's something that the Women's Sports Foundation is all about as well. And something that Billie Jean King has been fighting for over 40 years. And, you know, it's a mission and a drive that is not going to back down very easily.
And I don't think it was any surprise, was it, that they said they were going to appeal and continue to fight on based on, you know, everything that they have done and said in the past.
Exactly. They knew it would be a fight and they're up for it.
I guess I wanted to add, you know, how shocking the decision has been for a campaign. And it felt like a campaign that really enjoyed, you know, kind of global attention. It felt like the wave of popularity was on the women's national team side. There was the absolutely embarrassing US soccer lawyers in the early deposition papers just before Christmas that were trying to compare, you know, the speed and agility of women's men versus men, and try to say that the women's game is a lesser version of the men's, and the, you know, sponsors then ran, and Carlos Cordero resigned in a very embarrassing situation. So for this decision to come about feels like going against the grain, really. And I think a lot of people, you know, you can look on social media and people say, oh, well, this is obvious. But the argument is so very complex, whether it's, you know, why the women initially rejected the collective bargaining agreement in the first place. And you have to look at the lack of security that was offering the women's players. And so it made sense at the time that they did reject it, to, you know, the fact that the men have technically earned less than the women in the period that's being disputed. But that's because they didn't qualify for a World Cup. And had they qualified for a World Cup, they would have earned more. So, you know, there's so much about it that's really complex for people to understand. I think what's positive is that US soccer's response to this early decision has not been to come out, you know, celebrating. They have a new president, Cindy Cohn, who, of course, won the Women's World Cup back in 1999 and is really part of that. You know, I think in women's soccer, it's seen that you're all part of the same thing. And it feels like she can really be an ally going forward. So I think there is positivity to it, despite this setback from the judge.
There we have it. Alana Nichols, that's the president of the Women's Sports Foundation in the U.S., on the recent decision by the court there to reject a claim by the women's players for equal play. As they say, they're going to fight on. Sure, we've not seen the last of that development. But talking about developments, Curtis, we've not had any action on the fields of play over the past few weeks, but I think the only action in the region we've been having is in Trinidad and Tobago, and that's where we're heading for the latest on what has been happening in the ongoing saga with the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association and the FIFA. Of course, FIFA has instituted a normalization committee, and the William Wallace administration has been practically replaced. Since that has happened, we've had so many developments. And to talk to us a bit about what's the latest, I say good evening to Fazir Mohammed in Trinidad and Tobago. Good evening, Fazir.
Good evening, Paul. Good to be on the show.
Great to have you. And as I said earlier, the only action we've been having in the region in football has been in Trinidad and Tobago. The whole development of that situation is well known. Fazer, give me your take on, you know, what has happened so far.
Well, you know, Paul, Trinidad and Tobago is non-stop action. If it's one thing you could rely on, is Bacchanal in Trinidad, whether it's politics, sport, or war, whatever it might be. But just to update you, because I'm sure many of your listeners would be aware of these circumstances generally. Right now, it's basically a waiting game because the attorney is representing the deposed administration. And as you mentioned, the president being William Wallace, who was elected fair and square in November 24th of last year. They are now waiting for a date from the Court of Arbitration for Sport to put forward their case. They have done all that has been required. It has been registered by the Court of Arbitration, and it's now just a matter of them allocating a date for that hearing. From what we understand, it is to be a three-man committee. No names have been bandied about as yet. In fact, the William Wallace administration, they wanted a single arbiter in the matter, but apparently the CAS officials determined that it would be a three-member committee. And basically, we're waiting now for that date to be finalized. And of course, with the COVID-19, we're not too sure exactly when that date will be. In the interim, we've had a pulling and tugging over the TTFA accounts, which are lodged with the First Citizens Bank here in Trinidad and Tobago. And because of the normalization committee, obviously having the blessing of FIFA and headed by businessman Robert Haddad, they would have thought that they would obviously have access to those accounts. According to Mr. Wallace, though, and he's taken legal action against the bank if they were to try to release those funds to Mr. Haddad, he is saying that he is the duly elected president with his executive of the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association. And at the moment, the bank has basically decided that rather than go the way of risking litigation, either from the William Wallace side or the Robert Haddad side, they are saying no one can touch the money until there's clarification as to who exactly is running football in Trinidad and Tobago.
Well,
how is William Wallace being received in Trinidad? From our vantage point, from what we've read at least, when he first protested against being removed, he seemed to have lots of support, lots of sympathy. You know, how dare FIFA come here? This is how it was perhaps perceived, and remove a man who was duly elected. But now I'm seeing today it was written that the members of the FA, the administrative staff, and some of the coaches have not been paid for several months and have appealed to Mr. Wallace to just let it lie for the moment so they can be paid. COVID-19, everyone needs their salary now more than ever. Has his support base been eroded in Trinidad?
It really depends on who you talk to, because on the one hand, you have a situation where people are saying, look, even if you might be right on principle, there's no way you're going to beat FIFA. You're not even getting the support of the Caribbean Football Union, which is another talking point, because the deposed General Secretary, Keith Lucloy, who has been very outspoken on this matter early on when the issue of the normalization first came to the fore, basically saying that it's almost pointless having a CFU if you're going to have some 30-something members basically staying quiet with their tails between their legs because they don't want to jeopardize their funding from FIFA. And that's what people are saying. Look, even if you fight this all the way, you're going to lose. Even if you win, you're going to lose because you're going to be suspended by FIFA. You're going to be banned. Your young footballers, male and female, won't get the chance to play internationally. And at the end of it all, it'll be a pretty hollow victory, a pyrrhic victory, if you manage to achieve it. On the other hand, the other view is that, look, they are saying that in Trinidad and Tobago, chaos and football have gone hand in hand for a long time, from the days of Jack Warner, and even before that, preceding him. And many of you would be familiar with the issue surrounding such a high-profile personality as Jack Warner. And they are saying that, look, if it comes to us being suspended, at the moment it doesn't matter because no football is being played anywhere in the world and probably won't be played for a while. It's worth going through this fight if it's only to send a message that even tiny countries like Trinidad and Tobago will not be run roughshod over, because there's a significant point here. I don't know how important it will stand up in law. It's that the TTFA in Trinidad and Tobago has been formed by an act of parliament. It's not just simply a matter of this meeting the requirements of FIFA and being constituted in relation to that. It actually is a construct of the Trinidad and Tobago constitution via an act of parliament. And I think that is where the lawyers representing the TTFA and the deposed administration will be basing their case, essentially saying that Trinidad and Tobago is a sovereign state, it's a republic, and the laws of the land take precedence over that of any international sporting organization.
Well, Fazir, based on that statement, what has been the reaction from the government, from Minister Kutu?
Well, I think the government are taking a hands-off position at the moment. They don't want to be seen to be committing themselves either way, although by the mere fact that we had the presence of the Prime Minister, Dr. Keith Rowley, at the opening of the Home for Football mere days before that election on November 24th would appear to suggest that the deposed, the defeated president at the time, that was David John Williams, he had the support of the government of the day, because the Prime Minister was there, FIFA President Gianni Infantino was there, the CONCACAF President Montagliani was there. And just last Saturday in an interview, William Wallace said that he had heard talk, even before the November 24th election, that if his slate had won, if he had prevailed, FIFA would have been bringing in a normalization committee, basically to push him aside, because they more or less were favoring David John Williams' administration. So from the government side of things, I think they're lying low because they don't want to seem to be committed one way or the other. But just that presence at the Home of Football opening seemed to suggest that there was some definite support for the administration at that time.
Before what's not in doubt, Fazir, is that the future of Trinidad football is now very, very obscured, because you have the court case, and also coming out of the court case is win, lose, or draw for the normalization committee or the former president. We now have a number of former coaches, including Russell Lattery, lining up and saying, hey, but you owe us money. We need our money as soon as possible.
Absolutely. And the TTFA has been bankrupt for a long time. You might be aware that even after we qualified so famously and historically for the Senior World Cup football finals in Germany in 2006, and then the majority of players were blacklisted because they felt that Jack Warner had reneged on a promise to give them half of the bonus money, of bonus revenue from the World Cup, and they were subsequently blacklisted. That following that, there was a long protracted legal matter that resulted in those players actually taking legal action against the TTFA and seizing some of their property. So it's been scandal after scandal when it comes to football in Trinidad and Tobago. And that's why some people are saying that look, even if you have a situation where the game suffers as a result of it, you need to have some sort of a fine finality, some sort of sorting out of this issue once and for all, as far as the administration of the game, for Trinidad and Tobago football to get back on a solid footing.
Well, Fazir, I'm sure that we've not heard the end of this development. I'm sure there's a lot more that will happen over the coming weeks. We want to thank you very much for joining us this evening on Penalty Spot, and of course sharing your thoughts and developments that's happening there with that situation. Thanks a lot, Fazir.
You're more than welcome.
So, Curtis, from those comments from Fazir, that situation is going to roll on, I'm sure, for a few more months. Well, we're going to move away from Trinidad and Tobago and come back home. As we said last week, we have started what we've called player profile. Last week, we would have started with Anthony Daisy Clark, former Wales and national outstanding footballer. And we had to cut him a bit short last week. We have him back this week. Good evening to you, Daisy.
Good evening, Paul. It's a pleasure to be back here again this evening.
Great to have you on the show. And we've been, as a player in our profile this evening, last week we started to talk about your days at Wales. You were developing the point of moving from Wales into the under-19 team, it was, and then the senior national team. Maybe we can pick it up there and then look a bit at what happened after you went. You got the contract to go off to Scotland.
Yes, that was the highlight of my career, graduating to the senior national team back in 1983, under the leadership of Keith Griffiths being the coach and Ricardo Cracker Goddard being the captain. And I can clearly remember my first trials session, which was held at Harrison College School Ground, and that was a big occasion for me as a youngster. Just 22 years being called to trials with the senior national team, with the likes of Everton Harris, my cousin Wayne Lewis, Michael Edmire, Edward Smith, C4 Prescott, David Strong, Peter Haynes, Jerry Goddard, Philip Blackgrove, Gus Sandiford, all of these established players at the domestic level. And, you know, as a youngster, being at trials was just an honor. To go to that next level, having graduated from the youth level.
Well, Daisy, before we skip to the Scotland stint, I want to take you back to a little bit to club football. And playing for Wales at that stage, the clubs that would have been the ones that would have, you know, been the stronger teams that would have challenged Wales during that period of time?
You had Notre Dame at that time. You had Everton. You know, you had Pinelands. These were, as a matter of fact, the football was so competitive that even teams that you think were lesser teams, like maybe French United, they would still give you a hard run. But, I mean, the stadium would always be looking forward, and the fans would be looking forward for those big clashes against those top teams like Everton and Wales and another team and a Wales. And then as time progressed, you had teams like Gall Hill who joined and who graduated to Premier League and Paradise. And these were all the big games at the time.
Well, tell us a little bit about how that stint in Scotland came about.
At the time, I was representing Barbados. We were playing against St. Kitts in a friendly international game at a national stadium. And, I mean, that night, I set the field ablaze. I was immaculate. I was in top form that night. I really performed for, as an individual and for the team as well. And after the game, there was this scout from Scotland, and he was inquiring, he was told, in the stands about me. And he found his way to the changing room, and he had a discussion with me, and he asked me if I was, he's here on holiday, and if I'm interested in playing professional football. I said, sure, I'll give it a try. And he invited me to the hotel where he stayed on the West Coast. And 2 days or so, I visited him on the at the hotel. And the rest was history. He promised me, and he lived up to his promise, that as soon as he returned to Scotland, he's in contact with a whole cross-section of professional clubs. And he's sure with my ability that he can link me to a club. And about 6 weeks to 2 months after he returned, I was boarding a British Airways flight to London, on to Scotland.
And the club that you went on to?
This was the summer of 1989, and I'd been to Hearts of Midlothian, which is one of the Edinburgh clubs. And it was, at the time, it was a strange thing. And when I say strange, from the point of view that I was told that I was the first ever black player to go to that club on trials.
Well,
so I clearly remember that when the agent met me and stuff at the airport, he said, you are not playing any football this evening after long flights and everything. You're not playing any football this evening. You're just going to the club. You're going to meet the manager. You're going to meet the players and such like, and just watch the team training. And I did that. He collected me from the hotel. We went to the training session. And to be honest with you, Paul, I said, well, from observation, just watching the session, I said, well, I think I can make it here. And, you know, my trials was centered around matches every day, trial matches every day. And the first game I played in, there was a Man of the Match award. And I won the Man of the Match award for the very first game I played in. And I thought that I was on the way, but the trials went on. I was still doing quite good, but, you know, for some reason or the other, at the end of the 2 weeks, I didn't make it. But, you know, these things happen in life.
You mentioned earlier, Daisy, playing, having that excellent game. I think it was against St. Kitts.
Yeah.
I want to take you back to those days playing against some of the regional countries. I mean, in those days, Barbados certainly much more stronger than they were now in terms of playing against some of those regional countries.
During those days, during my career, during those matches, the only two countries that, in my opinion, that were stronger than us were Trinidad and Martinique. For some reason or other, we had a very hard time getting over Trinidad and Martinique. Man for man, we were on par with both Trinidad and Martinique, but I think that they understood the concept a little better than us playing as a team, as a unit, and this is where we fell down against Trinidad very often, as well as Martinique, even though with Martinique, the results used to be very narrow, like a 1-1 defeat or anything like that. Yeah. Trinidad would beat us with 2-1 or anything like that. But and we drew some games with Trinidad as well. But we used to, I mean, Jamaica qualified for the World Cup. And during that time, we used to defeat Jamaica every time we meet Jamaica. Mm-hmm. We hardly used to play Dominica and St. Kitts and those other islands. There simply weren't any match. We used to defeat St. Lucia, Grenada, name them. And we used to even defeat Guadeloupe, Suriname, Antigua, all these islands we used to handsomely defeat. As a matter of fact, having said that, I would remember in 1987, the Olympic qualifier, when we played the first game here against Jamaica, we had Jamaica leading 2-0, and they scored 2 late goals, and the game drew 2-2. The return game was in Jamaica in like a week time, and we were written off before we leave Barbados, that it was pointless of traveling to Jamaica. And this was a time when Jamaica was also beating the other islands at the office, as they named the national stadium in Jamaica. They say when you go to the office, you can't beat Jamaica.
That's
and,
right.
And we went to Jamaica. I must at this time also give a lot of credit for that win to Dr. Rudy Webster, who the BFA had employed as a sports psychologist. And he really got into our heads and made us believe that we can defeat Jamaica. And we went to Jamaica despite, against the odds and whatever people felt, so pumped up to win that game. And Adrian Hall scored a top goal. We won 1-0. And we had a hell of a time getting out of that stadium. I thought at one time they were going to push over the coach that was transporting us away.
But yeah,
I mean, just before as the game was coming to a close, when Jamaica knew it was all over, the track around the national stadium was literally filled with glass bottles. They were throwing bottles. I mean, we had to tiptoe through glass bottles. But I mean, that was a big highlight in my career, winning that game, especially when even your own country thought that you couldn't do it. That was a big highlight in my career, winning that and advancing to the next round, which was against Cuba, which was another powerhouse team at the time. And the first game again in the second round was against Cuba. In Cuba, and 2 late goals scored at a time also when Cuba was dismissing teams handsomely at Cuba. We lose 2-0, the return game played here, and the game drew 0-0, and we were eliminated from the tournament. Although I thought that we got a hard time in that game here when we scored first, and the goal was David Strong scored, and the goal was disallowed. And It was a lot of pandemonium for a little bit around the stadium because no one understood why how they could have fallen offside at that one, you know. But it was a tremendous game. It was a tremendous series.
Some great memories there. I can't let you go this evening, Daisy, before asking, getting your thoughts on. Football today, the state of local football, where we are, and where you think we can improve?
You know, I was speaking to some former players recently. We were having this discussion, Adrian Hall inclusive, even though he's in New York. We were chatting via social media. And, you know, you got to have a love and a passion for the game. And I'm not sure, I question if the the players have passion and that desire to really want to go to the next level. And when I say go to the next level, I mean like self-motivation. And I don't see players now really going out and working hard on their own, assessing themselves without a coach and recognizing where are your weaknesses, where are your strengths, getting stronger, getting better. And I spent countless mornings in Queen's Park before I go to school just trying to get better and better. And then I was still going to practice in the evening with a club. So that comes with a passion and a commitment, a desire. And now the players have so many more opportunities where they can get some more open now than in my time to play professionally, that should come like clockwork, you know what I mean, to put in that effort. But having said that, there are still some talented players in the country, and I see that the national setup is really they're making an effort to get better and go to the next level, and they're doing pretty good in the current tournament that was just abandoned due to the COVID-19, which should resume hopefully very soon.
Well, Anthony Daisy Clark, I want to thank you so much for sharing those wonderful memories with us of those golden years, I call them, and telling us a little bit about your career. Described last week by the BFA president as the Bajan Pelé. That's a high accolade, yes. Daisy.
I would also take this opportunity to acknowledge that the current president, Randy Harris, he has been around for a very long time. As I speak to you, I'm looking at a picture here that Randy was being the general secretary back in 87, and he went to Jamaica with that game. So Randy was always around. He started the Baiko tournament.
That's right.
Then he got involved with the best tournament. So Randy was around, and I must say he was pushing for the players during those days when very little was offered in terms of equipment and finances and stipends and things like that. As general secretary, you know, he did his utmost to try to reward the players, recognizing that we're representing country. And I mean, today he's president, and I'm sure he's following that trend in terms of the development of football in the country. And I want to salute Randy for his steadfastness going forward, also recognizing at a point of time in his career, as you remember, he was banned by FIFA, and that did not stop him. You know, he was just indomitable and returned, and today he's president and he's continuing that fight for football and footballers.
Well, Daisy, we want to also salute you for your contribution to football here in the Barbados and across the region. We want to wish you all the best. And once again, Anthony Daisy Clark, thanks again for joining us on Penalty Spot and sharing those wonderful memories and, of course, some of your thoughts. Thanks again,
Daisy. Thank you, Paul. It was a pleasure.
So there you have it. Anthony Daisy Clark, Curtis.
Yes, indeed. Taking us down memory lane, and really one of the icons of local football. I remember years ago, probably Italia 90 or the 94 edition, he was involved in a promotion, and it was a skills competition, traveling around to supermarkets and some of the venues across the island. I believe it was St. Philip, and was doing some juggling drills with a young player who thought he was good, and Daisy tossed the ball to him first. Young man got it to about 15-16, and then it was Daisy's turn. I don't need to tell you, Paul, what happened next.
Yes, the little stopped. Magician.
He stopped somewhere close to triple digits after putting it behind his neck, rolling it across his back, collarbone, flicking it up, spinning it.
Show the young boy so it should be done.
Give him a proper correction and education. Once again, thanks a lot to Anthony Daisy Clark. I believe we have Adrian Oki Donovan now online, a man who would have seen a lot of Anthony Daisy Clark these days. He's still very much involved in football, member of the BFA. He's also a club stalwart at Paradise, tonight's club which we feature on the Club Focus. Good evening to you, Hockey. And, wow, really nice memories there from Anthony Daisy Clark.
Good night, fellas. I didn't hear the whole discussion with Daisy, so I only wanted to see if he mentioned that historic game that he led Barbados, the Memorial One of Victory over Jamaica at the office. Did he mention that game?
Yes, he went quite much into detail on it.
Because they almost couldn't leave after the game.
Yes, we were pelted with bottles. I mean, Jamaica were not defeated at the stadium for over 15 years. And the Barbados are going there to defeat them in the backyard. They're simply outstanding, and Daisy was the captain of that team. So the Barbados saved a penalty kick, and Adrian Hall scored a spectacular bicycle kick.
Whoa.
Great memories.
Top players.
But back on the home team now. Hockey, of course, due to COVID-19, no football playing anywhere except a couple of leagues in Europe, which we really don't understand why they're still playing football. Paradise, how have you been coping? I know normally when I do a trip past the ground, I'm almost there almost every other day. There's always, I would say, on average, could possibly be 100 young men, different ages, different groups, several coaches, organized football, disorganized football, scrimmaging, close bars. But whenever you pass there, there's football. How has the club been coping now, especially at the Premier League level, where the suspension of football, trying to keep the guys motivated, all is not lost. And also from the youth level, because remember the BFA's youth competition was about 3 or 4 rounds old when all the football would have stopped.
Well, to put it mildly, the fellas are in pain. They are in pain.
I can imagine.
You get so many phone calls during the day that they want to come up and they could go on the scrimmage for another half hour. If we could play a 5-a-side, small goals, you know. The interest is definitely still there. The fellas want to get up the house environment. But they understand the bigger picture, that everything is on hold and they have to just hold train.
What's the latest now on your Trinidad based players who would have come over for the Premier League when we spoke last week? Not during the show, we spoke last week and they were hoping to get back home. They were waiting on an email and some documentation. Have they been successful or is the quartet still in Barbados?
No, the Trinidad government still have their border closed until the 14th of May. Hopefully that will not be extended. The fans were definitely disappointed. They were accessed by examined by local doctor Adrian Lord. There were clears. They made contact with the relevant people who chartered the flight with the 33 people who went back to Trinidad. And they were ready and eager to leave. We had transport on standby. They were packed, just waiting for that text or message saying that the Minister of National Security, Stuart Young, has granted permission for the 4 footballers to join the 33. So that has never came. And then you also have a situation whereby there are about 13 U.S. shooters here in a similar mode. They have not received any permission to travel. So they're all locked down. We gave them a football a few days ago to go on the Blenheim playing field. They're staying in the house in the Ivy. So they go sometimes early in the morning and do a little work by themselves. And then, unfortunately, could only spend the rest of the day at home.
Well, in terms of the club, no, Paradise, rich in history, 80s and 90s in particular, had a storied rivalry with Pride of Guildhall. And when those two teams met in the Premier League, you could walk through Christchurch, no one was at home. Everyone was at the National Stadium. When those two teams went head-to-head, some titanic battles, the likes of Dwayne Gale in particular, featuring for Paradise. I know it's now come full circle with this son, Thierry Gale, doing very, very well in Europe. Sure, some of the thoughts on the past and current Paradise stars, for those of the fans who might not be as aware of the past teams, let's say, more than 10 years ago.
Yes, that was a very traditional battle for bragging rights of who was the best in Christchurch. It was like when Man U plays Man City or Arsenal played Chelsea. Empire Press part in the cricket. Local derbies, crowds definitely came out. On the party side, we had fellas like Jude Ellis, Don Lee Gall, Anthony Charlie Chase, Adrian Lashley. And then from the Gotham side, now you had fellas like the City Boys, Terry and Ear, Jeffrey Chung Grant, Yaya. Well, the list goes on. These were household names. I mean, when you had to play at the stadium, let's say at 8 o'clock, pitch a game on a Sunday night, there was literally nobody in Gore Hill, Dover, Maxwell,
Silver Hill.
There was definitely nobody on the street. It is like, no. What did you say? Is it
lockdown?
Is it lockdown? Did the country was on curfew? All the minibuses were headed to the stadium. All.
Yes. I remember they were labeled side.
And you can, and not only footballers, but not only fans, but the girlfriends would bring the children. Even some mothers and fathers will come. You know, the rivalry was really there, intense. By the end of the day, we always had one or two fellas who would switch teams for whatever reasons. And the camaraderie, the love between the two teams were always there. I did a little memorial, short memorial the other day for former president Joe Edgell. A lot of people didn't know. But although Joe was our rival, Paris and Gore, we shared many things together. We shared many ideas together. But when we had to go and meet the big tongue teams, one day called Daisy Clark, we had to go ahead together and show how to topple Daisy. He may not have known that, because they know you listen to the program very well. But this is how we cooperated. Unfortunately, I don't think the baton has been handed over. Silver Sands are there and there about there, you know. They got some issues they got to sort out. Watson is now on board. And there's some other little teams in Christchurch, Fairlie Valley, potential ballers, or not in the lower divisions. But football in Christchurch was really at a very high level. So much so that the Christchurch League, which was run by a former man called Gordon Douglas, was instrumental in getting both Paradise and Gordon in the Premiership in those days.
As we begin to run out of time quickly, Oki, bring us back to the future. 2019-2020 season. What are the biggest challenges now for a club like Paradise? Been around for several years. You've seen a resurgence over the last 5 years. Expected to challenge for the title this season. Positives and negatives right now as you see them for the club structure on a whole in Barbados from your position as an administrator?
Well, we have some real big plans for this season. As you saw, we had a major sponsor who assisted us with bringing in 4 overseas-based players. They didn't come out at one time, so they weren't really here during the preseason. So the Beijing public really didn't have a chance to see them in full. And it has been a major setback to have these fellas here, you know, just for the last 6-7 weeks, just to come to play football and can't do anything. It's really a big blow. But then we also have some other fellas who are on the national team looking to take part in the Nations Cup against Guyana coming up. They're eager and ready to go. But when we start back, we have 8 teams at the club. We have three senior teams and 5 junior teams. And as Curtis rightly said, you can pass any afternoon and see a whole bunch of children running the boat. That is an organized activity. So therefore, all of us are just eagerly waiting to win this situation with the pass and get back to normal action.
And finally, Oki, what would you say is the secret of success for Paradise and the longevity in particular? We've had some well-known teams who have exited the league. Some have come back, and then very, very well, the likes of Wales. Gore Hill made an exit a few seasons ago now and are struggling to come back into the league. You mentioned the likes of Silver Sands and the other clubs. What's the secret at Paradise?
The success as Paradise has been the longevity of the leadership of the club. 90% of those who have run Paradise over the years, 90% have all come through the Paradise system, from junior football to senior football, national players or administrators. Out of, if I gave a call, 15 coaches who were leading our club at the highest level, at least 14 of them came to the party system. It is ingrown. It is a family thing of paradise. And not that you don't want outsiders, but that's how you structure the club. It's community-based. I remember some years ago, we brought in a coach from outside, a very respected coach, highly respected. But it was all hell in Dover. When you bring him on, he doesn't know anything about the club, doesn't know what structure, how it got funded. So these are things that really has kept us together. And it has worked for us because we have found, and the other clubs too, that sometimes you find a fellow from outside, he just comes for the money, the glory. There's no connection between he and the club or the community. And this is something is lacking in our football right now. Come with the club hopping, especially from the coaching level. But it's a business. It's a business nowadays. We have to do a program, Curtis, on Paul and this Trinidad fiasco. We got to set it up.
I'm sure we'll have a chance. I'll keep a look at that in other programs next week.
Yes.
Paul,
that's a whole
thing. That's the perfect thing to bloody this up. All right, Adrian. I know where we would head. So thanks once again to everyone who's been a part of this week's program. The challenges, of course, operating in a COVID-19 environment. Thank you to Adrian Aki Donovan, still on the line, Anthony Daisy Clark. A special thank you as well to Fazir Mohammed live from Trinidad and Tobago as we continue to take a look at what is going on in football locally, regionally, and internationally. On behalf of the entire team, it's a good night. You can check us next week, same time, same station, as we take you once again on the Penalty Spot.